lecture series. Actually, in the beginning, it was planned that I give only 7, I think, lectures. But then, unfortunately, Abhay Ashtekar had to cancel. So that's, of course, very bad. But the positive thing is that I have now the chance to give you a really good overview over the subject. So we have lots of time to together. And I invite questions during the lectures at any given point that something is unclear. It's quite late and people are tired, so I will start with a joke that I borrow from Jorge Pullin, and it goes like this. So I give you a little table. This is Newton's constant. This is 1 over the light speed, and this is h bar. And we're talking about several theories, and this is the major unsolved problem in this theory. So maybe some of you know this joke, but maybe sometimes some of you don't. So the first theory that we are going to talk about is Newtonian mechanics. You don't need to copy this, this is just a joke. So Newtonian mechanics, of course, Newton introduced Newton's constant. So Newton's constant is certainly not zero. Speed of light is zero. 1 over the speed of light is zero. C is infinity. And Newton didn't know about h bar yet. And the major unsolved problem is in celestial mechanics is that you can't solve the three-body problem. So that's the three-body problem. Next theory. I shouldn't write so big, maybe. Next theory is GR. GR. Here, of course, also we have G bigger than zero. C is finite, so it's bigger than zero. H bar is not there, otherwise, we would have quantum gravity. So this is zero. And here, people don't know how to analytically. Study the two-body problem. This is the most interesting things that people do in numerical relativity to collide two black holes. So, and no analytical solution is known. So that's the two. Then we go a little bit away from gravity. So we set Newton's constant equal to zero. And we do, let's say, relativistic quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, so C is also bigger than zero, and H bar is bigger than zero. And there you have problems with the one particle interpretation. As you know, there's Klein's paradox and so on and so forth. That's the one. The next thing then, and this was one of the solutions of the Klein paradox, is to go to quantum field theory, QFT. And there you have many particles. And in fact, if you do free field theory, then this is fine. So here also we neglect actually gravity. And this is bigger zero, this is bigger zero. So you have many particles, but then there's also a problem with the particle interpretation, especially when you're on curved spacetime. And what is known as the vacuum problem, what is the good ground state of the theory? So that's the zero. And now we do quantum gravity. And here everything is bigger than zero. But we don't know what this is. OK. So why is this so difficult? I mean, people are working on this for 60 years or so, or even more. I want to give you a small or a brief explanation for why this is so difficult. So why is constructing quantum GR so difficult? I think, and many people probably would agree with this, The reason for this is a short answer. So what is quantum general relativity? It's a theory that combines the principles of quantum mechanics and general relativity. So the short answer is that standard quantum field theory ignores one of the basic lessons of general relativity, which is background independence. So what one can clearly see this in actually the axioms of quantum field theory. One of the basic axioms of quantum field theory is the locality axiom. And this even works, this is applied even when you're not on Minkowski space, if you're on a curved space-time. So what you give as an input is a background metric. It could be the Minkowski metric, it could be a Schwarzschild black hole, it could be an anti-de Sitter space, a de Sitter space, some cosmological background, but anyway, you need some kind of background. If you know this background metric, you know the causality structure of the space-time, so you know how the light cones are constructed. And now what one can do is one can try to put quantum fields on such a space-time, where now a space-time is a pair consisting of a four-dimensional differentiable manifold, together with this metric on it, which, of course, for physics, the only interesting metrics are the ones which have signature minus plus 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 in four dimensions. Now we want to put quantum fields on this space-time, and we can smear these quantum fields. So phi hat of x is an operator-valued distribution. On M. And in order to turn it into an operator, I have to smear it. It's test functions. F. So we get an operator, phi of F, which is integral over the manifold d4x, f of x, phi hat of x. And the locality axiom says that if the following situation is given, there was here. If you're in a situation like this, that you have two test functions, f and f prime, which have such a support, this is the support of f, this is the region in M where f is non-vanishing, and that's the support of f prime, that's the region where f prime is not vanishing. And here the situation is like this, that these two supports are space-like separated, so I can draw a light cone in between them. These two regions cannot be in causal contact. If this situation is given, then this locality axiom says that the operators phi of f and phi of f prime have to commute. So, and this is for bosonic fields. So this is for scalar, for bosonic fields, bosonic scalar fields. And for fermion fields, this is a little bit different. But basically, the message is the same. Namely, what you need is a metric, differentiable manifold. So you know what the causality structure is. You know what the light cones are. So you know what space-like separated means. And if you know what space-like separated means, then we can construct an algebra of field operators. So the structure that you have in usual quantum field theory is a background metric from which you can conclude a causality structure. And from this, you can conclude the algebra of quantum fields. So, but this scheme, of course, is in clashes with the principles of general relativity, where the metric is not something that you give and then you let matter fields propagate on this metric, but it's something that has to be determined in tandem with matter. So there's a back reaction. There's curvature where matter is, and matter moves when moves on curved, I mean, on non-straight lines where there's curvature. So this principle, or this causality principle, has to be given up, or has to be modified in a theory of quantum gravity. So let me just write clashes with GR, which I write in this form, R mu minus 1 half G mu R. So with the Einstein equations, 8 pi G T mu, where there's back reaction between matter and curvature, and where certainly this metric has to be determined in dependence on the matter content. So clashes with GR, which is background independent. And in this workshop, you will hear about several background independent approaches, and loop quantum gravity is one of them. And loop quantum gravity is a canonical approach to quantum gravity. And in order to give a kind of self-contained account of all of this, what we have in loop quantum gravity, I want to talk about a little bit. I start very basic with the symplectic, or the phase-space structure of a theory with symmetries, or in other words, about field theories, or let's say canonical formulation. Canonical formulation of field theories with symmetries. Or, as we will see, with constraints. So we start from, usually we start in physics, we start from some Lagrangian L, which is a function if you're of some configuration coordinates and some velocities. And in order to switch to the canonical formulation, we want to perform what people call the Legendre transformation. What's the Legendre transformation? You define a function PA of Q and V to be given by dl by d dA. And then you want to define a Hamiltonian and reformulate the Euler-Lagrange equations in terms of Hamiltonian equations in terms of P and Q instead of Q and V. The problem is now that it typically happens that L is a so-called singular Lagrangian. Which can be written as determinant of d2l by dva dvb is equal to 0. This means that this equation cannot be solved for v in terms of q and p. So I will do this. I will do this for a finite dimensional case. So let me assume that A runs from 1 to m, and that the rank of the matrix d2l by dva dvb is equal to m minus r. Then this means that you can solve this equation here. We can solve star for m minus r velocities. And let me call them VA is equal to some function UA, which depends on Q, P, and well, on all the QAs, on all the PAs, and the remaining velocities, VI and I. So A runs from 1 to m minus r, and I runs from 1 to r. So when you plug these solutions into the remaining equations, then you must get what people call primary constraints. So if you solve, or when you plug in into the last R equations, dl by dvi, when va is equal to ua, you get a function which cannot depend on velocities anymore, but only depends on qa, qwa, and pa. Yeah? Which one?
So your p's right now, you have m p's. Shouldn't you have m minus r p's? And should you have m p's?
No, I really do have m p a's. And well, you have m velocities and you have as many momenta. So you really do have m p a's. No, that's precisely the point. You cannot solve for all velocities in terms of.
But if you're keeping R,
Yeah, I do keep the VIs. I cannot get rid of them. So they are inside here. So you get an, if you plug this in here, if you would get an equation which would still involve the Vs, then the rank would be higher. So that would be a contradiction. So this can't be anymore depend on the Vs. Okay? So this equation is called a primary constraint loss. And we have R primary constraints. Now we can define so-called primary Hamiltonian. And this is defined in the usual way, H prime of Q capital A, PA, and VI is equal to PA So this is the primary Hamiltonian, and one can show, I will not show this, this is an elementary exercise if you want, that H prime is always of the form H tilde of QA and PA plus velocities VI times phi I. QA and PA. And phi I are the primary constraints. So this primary Hamiltonian always has a piece which is independent of these velocities and a piece which is linear in velocities, and it's automatically linear in these primary constraints. That piece may be vanishing also, identically. And we will see that in general relativity, that is actually the case. So what you can also show, by the way, is that the equations Q dot A is equal to dH prime by dPA. P dot A is equal to minus dH prime by dQA. And dH prime by dVI equal to 0 So this set of equations is equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equations. Okay, now we were going to perform a certain algorithm which is known as the Dirac algorithm. So let me denote by C the set of all points, so of all pairs, let's say, Q and P, in the phase space, such that phi I equal to 0. So it's the constraint manifold. Now we study the following equations. So one of these the equations of motion, namely this one, says that the constraints should be imposed, so the system should be on the phase space. So we want that this constraint manifold is dynamically stable. So we have to study the equations of the constraints themselves. So we have to study phi dot I, which is same as h prime by phi I. So and now three different cases can happen. The first case is that phi dot I restricted to the constraint manifold is identically satisfied. Let's say this happens for I running from 1 to some alpha. The second case is that phi dot I restricted to C is not equal to 0. For, let's say, I running from alpha plus 1 to some beta, however, that phi j with phi I restricted to C is equal to 0 for all j from running from 1 to r. And the third case is that phi dot I restricted to C is not equal to 0 for I running from beta plus 1 to some r prime. To r. And the matrix phi j comma phi I were restricted to C where j runs from 1 to r and I runs from beta plus 1 to r has maximal rank. As maximal rank r minus beta. The point of asking that, so it could also happen that the rank is lower than the maximal one, the maximal possible one, but this would be bad because in this case it would not be possible. So remember that h prime has two pieces. It has also these velocity dependent pieces. If the rank would be smaller than the maximal one, you could not solve these remaining r minus beta equations by choosing these Lagrange multipliers. So if you couldn't do that, then at this point you would conclude that the theory is inconsistent. This is why we exclude this case. It happens that you can write down Lagrangians for which this happens, and these kind of Lagrangians are indeed inconsistent. Yeah. These are the Poisson brackets. Okay, so by the Poisson maybe I write this here. So my conventions is the following. Poisson brackets. So my convention is that PA QB is delta AB. And then you get these Hamiltonian equations of motions that I wrote here. You get with the convention that, let's say, for any function on phase space F, F dot is the same thing as H prime comma F. So if you want, you can also write these Poisson brackets as F comma G is df by dpa dg by dqa minus f and g interchanged. So this is an aside. So okay, so,
sorry.
Yeah?
What's happening if the matrix has not...
That's what I just said. If the matrix doesn't have maximal rank, then you remember that H prime is equal to H tilde plus VI times phi j's, and here we sum, of course. This is Einstein convention, so I'm summing from j equal to 1, from 1 to r. So if the matrix has the maximal rank, then I can always find velocities in order to solve the equation phi dot equal to 0 for beta plus 1 to r, I equal to beta plus 1 to r, in order for beta, r minus beta velocities. So I can always choose the velocities in such a way that I can actually make this zero. If the rank is not maximal, I can't. Then your system is inconsistent because the evolution drives you away from the surface. But one of the equations of motion told you that you have to go to the surface. So the equations are contradicting each other. Okay, so now we look what happened. So this equation we can always somehow satisfy by choosing the velocities. This equation doesn't pose any new problems because it's identically satisfied. This equation gives you new constraints. So this was, let's say, the first iteration step. Now your second iteration step. Redefine R to R plus, what is it, beta minus alpha. And C, the constraint surface, now involves all the points P and Q such that phi I is equal to 0 from I running from 1 to our new R. Let's call it R prime. So I've added these constraints. Phi I is equal to, let's see. Phi I dot minus R plus alpha for I equal R plus 1 to R plus beta minus alpha. So these are new constraints, which are these equations here, which cannot be satisfied so far. So now you go through this exercise again, and again and again until it stops. So iterate algorithm until it stops. And for finite dimensional systems, of course, it always stops after a finite number of steps, because at least at each step, the number of equations that you get in addition, the number of constraints that you get in addition, is increasing at least by one. So let R prime be the final value of R. C the final constraint surface. Then we have the following situation. Phi dot I C is identically zero for I is from 1 to alpha. And phi dot I C is equal to, so you iterate until it stops, and what does it mean that it stops? And case 2 no longer appears. So you don't it generate new constraints. OK. So this is the situation that you end up with then. Phi dot C is equal to H tilde comma phi I C plus some phi j comma phi I c by vi. Notice that here the sum really runs only from 1 to r, not to r prime. This is why I'm explicitly writing the sum here. So now we can choose a solution. Let vi be y vi naught plus lambda mu vi mu. Is there a question? So, and vi naught is a special solution. To this equation. And vi mu is a basis of solutions to the homogeneous equations. Yuri, when should I stop?
You can stop actually now or in 5 minutes if you want.
Okay. So then let me just make some basic definition. Definition. A function f of qa and pa is called first class provided that phi j f c is equal to 0 for all j equal to 1 from 1 to r. Actually, maybe we should. So let me do this like this. Lemma. Let phi mu be vi mu phi I. Then we can write this Hamiltonian in the form h tilde, h prime is equal to h tilde plus vj naught phi j. And mu, so mu runs, let's see, from, thank you for the question, 1 until the original r minus r prime minus alpha, and is the number of possible homogeneous solutions. It's the basis of solutions to the homogeneous equation. So this is V naught is a special solution to the inhomogeneous equation, if this term is there. So you solve this equation, and then, of course, you can always add solutions to the homogeneous equation. So, and then you can show the following thing. Number one, phi mu, or let me call this h, not h prime, sorry. Phi mu and h are first class. Secondly, first class functions form a sub Poisson algebra. In other words, if you take two first-class functions and you take the Poisson bracket between two first-class functions, it's again a first-class function. So I leave this as an exercise and stop for today. Thank you.